Welcome to the LSE Events Podcast by the London School of Economics and Political Science. Get ready to hear from some of the most influential international figures in the social sciences.
Hello, everyone. Can you hear me? Hear me at the back? Thank you. Okay, so we are ready to begin. I chair quite a few LSE events because that's part of what one does. My name's Elizabeth Robinson. I'm a professor of environmental economics, director of Grantham Research Institute, seconded to being acting dean of our new Global School Sustainability soft launching in January. I chair a lot of events, but this is probably one of the most exciting ones because, probably like you guys, I love to watch movies, which is part of why we're here. I really care about climate change. And normally I'm just watching it. It's not often, one, I get to actually introduce the film, but also to actually have the director here, who is going to properly introduce the film for you and then be part of a Q&A afterwards. So can I just say right now, don't walk off as the credits roll. Please stay for the Q&A because, you know, that's the movie's great, but the Q&A is going to be even better. So there's a few things I have to say before I bring our director on stage. So this is an LSE public event. If you tweet, we have a hashtag LSE events. We're not expecting a fire alarm. So if the fire alarm goes off, it means it's a real one. So please follow people in the red T-shirts. They will lead you safely out of the auditorium. Could you please follow movie protocol? So when the movie's on, just like you're in a movie theater, no phones, please. So we'll switch those to silent and not be interrupting people with light. So I think that's all the stuff I'm supposed to say. I think I've done my dutifuls, but welcome. Welcome to this event where we are going to screen Cobalt Rush, The Future of Going Green, which investigates the human and environmental costs associated with extracting minerals for the transition to net zero. We have a panel Q&A, followed by a Q&A from the audience afterwards, and I'll introduce the panel guest to you. But first of all, I just want to introduce our director of the movie. This is Quentin Noir-Falis, Belgian journalist, director and documentary producer. He's directed four feature movies, and you've been telling us about four feature documentaries, sorry, and you've been telling us about some upcoming ones as well, so we're waiting to watch those in 2026. There's Cobalt Rush that was made in 2022, and more than 15 documentaries for theatrical releases and major European broadcasters. You specialise in corporate responsibility, human rights, supply chains, natural resources, climate inequalities, with a focus on DRC Congo, where you have lived before now. Yeah. So let's welcome the stage with a huge round of applause, Quentin Noir-Falis.
Hi. Thanks a lot, everyone, to have come here tonight. So they asked me to make like a short introduction about the film. It's an investigative documentary that we've made over the course of 3 to 4 years about the cobalt mining supply chain. So there is a lot about DR Congo, which amounts to roughly 60% of the annual production of cobalt mining. And this cobalt is hugely dedicated to the battery sector and so to the green transition in Europe, but also in the US and obviously in China. So the film is about that and about the impact on the daily lives of people living next to these mines in the DR Congo. And we will have like plenty of time to answer all your questions afterwards. So enjoy the screening and thanks again.
Hi. I'm interrupting this event to tell you about another awesome LSE podcast that we think you'd enjoy. LSE IQ asks social scientists and other experts to answer one intelligent question, like, why do people believe in conspiracy theories? Or, can we afford the super rich? Come check us out. Just search for LSE IQ wherever you get your podcasts. Now, back to the event.
So do stay for the Q&A if you want to. We're starting now. Goodness me, what a powerful and sobering film. And thank goodness for people like Quentin who make these films for us.
Yeah.
I don't think we're sophisticated enough to fade out the sound here at LSE. But that was Cobalt Rush. So thank you so much. I just want to let you know that we'll have a few questions, and there will be a recording of the Q&A. So just to let you know, if you're asking questions, this may or not become part of a podcast. So I just want to introduce you to our other two panel members. So we've got Richard Perkins, an associate professor at the Department of Geography and Environment, and an associate at Grantham Research Institute. His research interests focus on the governance of climate and environmental change by both public and private actors. And his most recent work is on interrogating sustainable and green finance. So great to have Richard here with us. We had mentioned in the publicity for this we were going to have Annika van Woudenberg, who I think we saw on the film, didn't we, for a few minutes. Unfortunately, she's had a last-minute emergency. But wonderful to say, we've got our colleague Leah Reitmeier. So thank you so much for filling in at the last minute. She's a policy analyst at GRI. She works with the Centre for Economic Transition Expertise. She's got a lot of work experience in private bank, chief sustainability office in investment bank, and is one of the people who's really driving quite a lot of our work in this area. So thank you so much for filling in at the last minute. Before I just come and join the panel, because sometimes I forget to do the thank yous at the end, so I'd just like to say thank you to all the people behind the scenes who make this happen. The people in red shirts from LSE, thank you. My colleague Shiranaz from Grantham Research Institute, who helps us with so many events, thank you. And, you know, this week we were able to show a movie with very smoothly, so thank you for all the technicians and engineers from LSE who are helping with that. So do the thank yous now, and I'm going to hop over there, and we will start with questions. So while I ask some questions, please do have your questions planned, because we will try our very best to have a good sort of 10 to 15 minutes of Q&A, but I just want to start, Quentin, and thank you again for producing such a fantastic and powerful film. So Cobalt Rush, it delves into the sort of the human and environmental impacts of cobalt mining. From your experience of directing this documentary, what did you find sort of most surprising or overlooked about the global supply chain for cobalt? And given that we need a transition to net zero, how do these sort of revelations shape how we need to approach that transition to net zero?
Yeah, I think that what was really interesting is that I've been working on Congo since 2008. In fact, I made my internship there in a local newspaper as a journalist, covering the wars in the east. They were not in the eastern region, so cobalt is not a mineral conflict. I just want to precise that. What was really striking for me was just like the huge dependency of so many people on only one commodity, which is like copper, cobalt, like two commodities in fact, but like on mining, like you have to know that 4 to 5 million people depends on that for their daily livelihoods, directly or indirectly, children, mothers, and so on. And the thing is that paradoxically, Congo, you can have like 3 crops a year when you're running a farm, because like it's on the equatorial level, and everybody left farming to go to mining because you basically earn every day more or less 8 to 10 times what you can earn while making family farming in the Congo. So it's just like when we say about mining towns, it's just like a one business town all over the world. It's nearly a one business country, Congo. Say 40% of the GDP comes from mining. And I think that's what really strikes me because it drives everyday lives so much in that region, but also in many other regions in the eastern part of the country.
Thanks. So I just carry on with this idea that we need a transition, Richard. And, you know, as we were told, you know, if you need a car, get a bike. But we know that many of us aren't. We're going to get EVs and we're going to see our buses and trucks maybe electrical as well. So, Richard, maybe just talk to us about the role of technological change in this process of transitioning to net zero and what implications this will have for critical minerals.
Huge implications. When we actually look at a lot of these critical raw materials, they're central to many modern technologies we see around us today. We've done some work at the LSE looking at information and communication technologies and the relationship between critical raw material demand, including cobalt, and ICTs. where a lot of the current anxieties are about are in relation to the energy transition and low carbon transition. And here we see many of these low carbon technologies being more mineral intensive than their comparative high carbon technologies. So we see this in electric vehicles, we see this in renewable energy technologies. And we are going to need a huge amount of these critical raw materials for this energy transition. Just in the European Union, for example, we're going to need about 20 times more lithium by 2050. This is huge amounts of raw materials for these transitions. Saying that, technological change can also help us reduce our demand on some of these critical raw materials as well, both through recycling, both through material substitution. So in cobalt, there's potential opportunities to substitute away from cobalt in batteries and in other applications. This, of course, has to be offset against scale effects. So even though we may be able to reduce the amount of cobalt which goes into each battery, the scale keeps on rising. So this is one of the problems we confront at the moment. And just finally, I'd say it's not just about technology. It's also about aspects like behavioural change. So I watch this video and sometimes I think, what sort of world do we live in when we have these kind of 2-tonne, 2.5-tonne electric vehicles generating huge amounts of demand for these critical raw materials? Should we be thinking about whether this is the right thing to do or whether we should be thinking about different forms of mobility? So it's not just about technology, it's about other aspects as well.
Thanks. Now I'm going to move on to you, because I was just thinking, I was mindful that we see the impact of this cobalt mining on agriculture, and I've seen, you know, similar sort of but shorter films about the impact of oil and all the oil spills and the bad management of oil, you know, on Nigerian farming. And so this is not new. Wherever we mine, we seem to see destruction. So we've now moved away from oil, which has caused lots of spills and damage, to cobalt, which is being similarly mismanaged and causing spills and damage, whether in Finland or DRC Congo. It's really nice to see that juxtaposition of, you know, one of the richest countries and one of the poorest, and still seeing the same problems of companies just not being responsible, I guess. And the next sort of frontier layer, and I know you've been pioneering a lot of this work for us at Grantham and really leading on this, is oceans and deep sea mining. So, you know, if we then decide we can move away from cobalt, abandoning, you know, these countries where we've now destroyed, left huge scars, what can you sort of tell us a little bit about whether we're close to seeing commercial deep sea mining operations? Isn't it going to be just the same old? Are we going to have a movie from you, Quentin, in 2 years' time? You know, is it going to be the same story layer?
No, thank you so much. And I suppose, yeah, that's what I worry about as well. So right now, in the high seas, so the area beyond national jurisdiction, we cannot exploit minerals because there are no rules around how to do it, how like the environmental impact assessment should be conducted. Generally, the high seas, that's like depths of like 3,000 meters, 4,000 meters. So high pressures, a lot of uncertainty. We don't really understand that area from a kind of ecological perspective yet. So there's this body, the International Seabed Authority. They have planned to come up with kind of rules on how this exploitation could take place, and they want to do this by next year. They've like pushed it forward a number of times because it's just so challenging to come to a global agreement on that. In the meantime, there have been over 30 governments that have kind of positioned themselves against this. They'll say we just don't have enough data, enough knowledge about the potential impacts that has. And important here to mention, of course, the ocean is one big interconnected ecological system. So like impacts, like environmental harm we have on one side, they can transmit easily to other areas through the water. So the impacts on fish, for example, when we're taking out those minerals, they have toxins in it that might kind of be then picked up by the fish, and impact then, of course, us as humans, what we eat as well. Then there's, I think, one impact, and you mentioned, or one aspect, lithium. Personally, so the area that we are currently looking at from potentially commercially mining is the Clipperton Zone in the Pacific Ocean, and that is actually, that holds polymetallic nodules. They have 91% of manganese. They have 0% of lithium, 1% of cobalt. So there will be like questions, okay, yes, there are minerals, but are those the minerals that we really need for the transition? And there have been academic studies to look at kind of like the trade-offs between, okay, on the terrestrial side versus the ocean. Of course, we've seen like the social impact that has on like terrestrial mining. But I think to mention here, to be wary that a lot of the studies have been actually funded by companies or research institutes that are proponents of this of deep sea mining. Generally, I think also from a kind of more economic finance perspective, the business case of many of those companies is quite highly questionable. Of course, they are assuming that the prices of minerals go up, and also in terms of the mechanisms, the tools that we can mine those minerals, it's not tested on a commercial scale. Kind of overall, I think my take would be, we've destroyed already so much on land. We should maybe kind of focus on fixing that rather than destroying the ecosystem.
So Quentin, we saw some hints in your movie, I guess, that, you know, people are looking for solutions, not really working so well yet. Do you see any role for international bodies, frameworks, legislation in influencing sort of better practices?
Well, the main issue is that, like most of all these international frameworks, notably the OECD guidelines, you know, like maybe like the five steps, you have like to learn about your supply chain, you have like to identify human rights or corruption issues, then you have to fix them, then you have to be transparent about that and publish that on your website and then follow up. Well, most of them, they only make, like most of these companies, they only make the two or the three first steps, and afterwards they are not like really, really transparent. I just have an example. You have like Umicore in Belgium, which is like the biggest refinery in Europe when it comes to cobalt, which is the old mining colonial company. They made a lot of money. The uranium for the atomic bomb, it's them. And we came after the film when, say, like Glencore pleaded guilty for corruption in the Congo. So if you follow the OECD guidelines, then it's a red flag, and you cannot source from them anymore. And Umicore answered us after the film, yeah, but you know, it was the old management, it was 2013, and we think that the management has improved now. And, you know, it's that, oh, it's the Chinese, Quentin. And I say, okay, it's funny, but you don't respect then the OECD guidelines. And we have a lot about that because these guidelines are not, they are only advisory. So right now in the EU, not in the UK, but in the EU, we have this like overall due diligence directive that's going to slowly be put in place. It's going to take 2 or 3 years. And the main issue is that what is the manpower and the money we're going to put behind that to implement that, because people in Europe either working for BMW or Volkswagen or any car maker, or people working for public institutions in charge of following like these guidelines, they've never been to a mine. In fact, they don't know it works, they don't know what's like. We've been in those pits and so on. We don't ask them to go to those pits, but just to talk to the people, and not in the framework of a big OECD meetings where everything is a bit faked and the schools are running and they're repairing the roads.
When you say they haven't visited the mines, I found the images of going down the artisanal mine quite shocking, and I was sort of starting to feel quite claustrophobic just watching it. I think many of us just really didn't quite realize just what it meant to sort of have an artisanal mine under that orange sheet. Mm. So that was amazing filming that. Get your questions ready. I'm going to just ask two quick questions of our panel, and then we will ask questions. So get them ready. But I can see some hands, and I will call on them soon. Just a quick one, Richard. Just you work a lot in green finance, and you know, again, we've got this difficulty that we know there's an urgency to transition, but you know, we need to do it better than we're doing it at the moment. Transition to net zero. How do you feel what role sort of investors have to play in the allocation of capital that can influence us doing this better?
Investors are very important, both because they will allocate the capital for all the new mines we'll need, for all these batteries and other devices which are part of the low carbon transition. Investors are also potential governors in this space as well. So there are responsible investors out there who do care about these issues and can potentially exert pressure on some big mining firms at least, in which they hold capital, to improve their mining practices. So investors are potentially a governor out there who can put pressure on there. But we've got to be careful not to exaggerate their influence. Investors own shares in certain companies, certain large mining companies, but there's other parts of the value chain in mining in which big institutional investors, who are the responsible investors, don't have a lot of equity, don't have a lot of influence, potentially can't change a great deal in this particular area. And we have to remember investors are investors. Investors are essentially concerned with risk and return. That's what most investors are concerned with. And the risk and return ratio doesn't always work particularly well in certain areas of mining, that's for sure. And I think with any form of private governance, we also have to ask whose interest is being served by this. I was already struck by this video, sort of seeing the faces of people who are working in the mines, the people who are impacted by that, and contrasting that with the kind of corporate social responsibility we often see in brochures and on websites, and thinking, whose interests are some of these private initiatives serve? Are they really about ensuring a social license to operate for these big mining firms and reducing their reputational risks? Or are they really about the communities we see in these videos? And I think these are questions we have to ask ourselves when we start to consider private governance and the limits to private governance. And then we have to think also about state governance at the same time.
Thanks. And Leah, just and if the roving mics are getting ready too, just a quick follow-up. The banks? Do the banks have responsibilities, roles?
Yeah, for sure, and maybe a quick disclaimer, I haven't done empirical work on that, so that's kind of based on my personal experience working in the sector, but also kind of trying to do a bit of research this week to look at what's being done. And yeah, I think banks are very important, of course. We know their role in providing credits. They have like this standing relationship with their clients, but also within the investment bank, for example, you have like a strategic role. So like if there's a merger and acquisition happening, you can also kind of influence and direct your clients there, and on the facilitating side as well for like debt issuances, where you kind of play the intermediary between the investor and your client. So various different aspects. I think one issue I see is that on kind of the bank client coverage side, yes, you do have like sectoral teams, but they are very much focused on like assessing the financy parts of like a balance sheet and understanding the company from that perspective. You have like the ESG teams who are often not very specifically focused and trained on the sectors, but have to have a broader view. So there's a high reliance on like kind of ESG ratings, so environmental, social, and governance ratings. And yeah, as I said, I kind of like spent a couple of hours like shifting through some reports to see how is kind of like the issue of like raw materials mining being reflected within those for car companies. And kind of, as I said, not non-empirical, but just for insights and maybe to encourage someone to look into that further. But I have like thought that a lot of focus is actually on the impacts of not getting the materials to sell your cars. So that's kind of like the financial aspect, of course. There's focus on the water aspect, but yeah, the social side is fully neglected. So that's kind of the thing. And then for a 100% EV company manufacturer that I have here, the verdict was that the company's exposure to resource use supply chain issues is low and similar to the sub-industry exposure, which I think is, yeah, given what we've just seen, a bit questionable.
I love the fact that we're having a film showing and our Q&A includes proper academic research here at LSE, so thank you, Leigh. Okay, we've got about 10 minutes. The more questions there are, the shorter the answers need to be, guys, so we can get through the questions. There's lots of questions. So I've got, and remember, if you can introduce yourself, that's fine. Keep the questions short, please. I've got a question here at the front, and then person with the hat, wave at me. Yep, you're on the second one. We'll do three in a row. And I have to go back a little bit. And then the third one will be you there, yeah? So, thank you.
Yes, my name is Stefano Bonfa. I'm from Oxford Sustainable Development Enterprise. And my observation is regarding the approach. From one side, we need critical material. From the other side, we have this demand and supply compensation. In these two contexts, I think, especially in Europe, we have to think in terms of circular economy. In a way, the idea is if we do not have the concept of data, this means we don't know yet in Europe this, as I can say, the critical material, where they are, so we cannot plan, we cannot make any strategy. So I have a project, for example, now.
Just because we've got a lot of questions. Okay. Do you have a question?
The question is the approach that is still not, let's say, appropriated on developing economy, social, and environment, that I think the circular economy is the right way. Thank you.
Second question.
Hello, my name is Isabel, and I work in the data center industry. And my question is, what, if any, should the West's approach be towards China, considering how they, per the documentary, sort of dominate the DRC's cobalt industry? And then the kind of sub-question of that is, should there be taxes on the Chinese sales of cobalt in Western markets, or due to the fast approaching EV mandates, is that just not feasible?
Thank you. And then our third question, you got Mike, great.
Yep. Hi, my name's Arka. I'm an environmental economics student here at LSE. A question for Quentin. I'm curious to know a little bit more about your motivations for making this movie and whether you had a criteria for success of the movie, what would make you say it was successful? And one last thing for the rest of the panel, We've talked about how we've got hardcore researchers on the same panel talking about topics discussed in a movie, and I'm curious to understand some of your approaches in making your research, which can be technical and obviously quite rigorous, more accessible to policymakers, members of the general public, whether you think that is part of the role of researchers and academics to make their findings more relatable and accessible to people.
Thank you. So we've got circular economy, what do we do about China, and this link with academic research. Quentin, do you want to start with that, and then if the others want to pick up on one of the other questions?
I'll try to answer shortly to a bit of three questions. First question, the motivation is, it's mainly about, I've lived in Congo, I've covered, mining and natural resources since quite a long time. I have friends there. When you make such kind of film, you make friends also, like all these activists, Celestin, the scientist, Donna, they become friends all over the time, and you see their struggle, and you want sort of what you can do as a journalist, just you can be a messenger and try just, so that's basically the daily job that we do. In terms of success, right now the film has been watched by 20 million people. You're a bit the last ones in the process, but the BBC didn't buy it, so that's why. So it's good, but I'd say in terms of trying to reach the politicians, it's always difficult. Mining is a really complex issue. All local politicians in Belgium are not really interested into that because it's quite far away. And in the Congo, the new regime has really switched into putting family members into artisanal mining, and the situation is really bad at that time. It's not the same way as before, where you were huge deals with huge corruptions. It's small deal with a lot of corruption. So I'd say that it was good to present the film, introduce the film in schools in Katanga to all the women of these miners, because they're not allowed into the mines because they give bad luck. So they watch the conditions, the working conditions of their husbands. So local impact's good, national impact's not that good. And I guess in Europe that is sensitive, awareness rising. For circular economy, they try to get 10% of their cobalt by 2035 out of the circular economy. You have some losses because the industry says you're never going to lose cobalt, you're going to get 90-95% out of 1 kilogram of cobalt, but it's not true. So they need to improve the processing. No, it's not true. They're faking the numbers. So you need to have proper public investment into that. And I guess in general, and this is something I wanted to say that's not in the question, the price of cobalt right now is around $24,000 a ton. When we shot the film, it was $75,000. So it's a highly volatile raw material. And you have, like, it's not a switch because they will need cobalt until like 2050, quite a lot. But also the demand in China is much more lithium iron phosphate batteries. And the iron sector has the same issues. So if you listen to somebody says, you do not need to care about cobalt because it's going to be like, it's going to fade away and so on. It's not going to be true because the mining issues, when it comes to corruption, pollution and so on, you can switch from one metal to the other. You still often have the same issues.
And does anyone want to answer the question on China?
I have a go at it. I can't claim to be an expert in this area. I think some of our politicians perhaps been a bit of asleep at the wheel on the kind of China issue, woken up over the past 5 years to find that China is dominating large parts of the value chain for some of these critical raw materials. And this is some of the impetus, of course, behind things like the Critical Raw Material Act in the EU, to think, actually, China's very dominant. We've got to diversify our supplies. We've got to think about that, because if we don't do that, it can potentially choke off the energy transition. As to tariffs, will this really help? Well, I don't have a full answer to that. But there's a danger with tariffs. You can also slow down the energy transition with tariffs without achieving other goals at the same time. But I think we probably need sort of multi-tiered policy to deal with this. Including thinking about how we can move away from some of these critical raw materials, have more recycling and circularity in these particular areas, and diversify our supply sources.
Leigh, do you want to have a quick response on the academic side?
Yeah, sure. And I suppose, yeah, maybe just to provide an example, I think actually at GRI we have a really nice approach to that. Of course, we have kind of our academic, like, extensive reports, but I've personally done a lot of, I have great experience with the kind of explainers, which are shorter, kind of very, like, straightforward, easy to understand, hopefully easy to read papers. And yeah, I think I've had more people reach out to me to ask questions or to clarify things on the back of, like, explainers than actually, like, really long reports that took forever. But within the explainers, we can then link to other reports. So I think that's a really kind of nice way to, yeah.
I think I'm going to be allowed to squeeze one more round of questions in. We'll be allowed that. Oh, my gosh, there's so many questions. Okay. I'm going to go all the way. You at the back, wave at me till you know it's you. Yeah, no, that's you. You're not all the way back. Sorry, yeah. That's one. Wait, one, two, because you had your hand up a while, and...
I can answer afterwards.
Sorry?
I can stay afterwards.
Yeah, and three there. Very quick questions, we'll have very quick answers. Yeah, and thank you so much. You can come and direct to the director afterwards, yeah.
My name is Richard Tullis. I'm an infrastructure financier. My question really is about the midstream, which is kind of, yeah, the bit, I guess, the bit between the mining and the production of cars and so on. It was interesting you had Northvolt featured in this film, who've subsequently gone bust or suddenly, you know, run into a lot of trouble. To what extent do you think the midstream in the kind of Western world is actually stable enough to actually provide a platform to address policy issues like this? You know, the Chinese model, which appeared to be a lot of state involvement driving this, creating a critical mass in the midstream, seems to be really fundamental. Without that, seems to be awfully difficult, A, to build an ecosystem to in the West to compete with that, and B, really difficult to have a platform that's going to care about environmental issues. Just wondering how, do we see, given the Northvolt experience, is it sustainable in Western markets?
Thanks. And who's number two? You must know.
this question for Quentin, around the kind of building those relationships with the communities. You know, what do they really want out of the dynamic? You know, a lot of the time they were mentioning amounts they want to get paid, and it was a tiny fraction of what they really deserved. So, yeah, in that process of getting to know them, I'd love to know what was your learning experience from that.
And then the third one?
Hi, Luca. I worked with RAID, the organization that Annika is part of, but I'm also a student here. Sort of to everybody on the panel, what I've been really shocked by this in the video is the fact that they say that they can't monitor global value chains. And we know that NGOs can do it better than the companies themselves. even without the resources and all the auditing that goes on. There was a report that came out by Amnesty a few weeks ago precisely on this and ranking all these car companies. When does this excuse stop being valid, and when does this excuse start translating to actual policy action and restricting these sorts of excuses?
Brilliant. We're over time, so I'm going to ask Quentin to have the last words on all three questions.
Oh, thanks. No, we need like 30 minutes for the first one. No, like I'd say, like I just like a small story. So the US company called Freeport McMoRan, big mining company, had a really big mine in the Congo, which was the second biggest cobalt copper mine. Tenke-Fungurumet is the name of the mine. And a few years ago, they had two solutions. It's just like, you know, there is this Global Magnitsky Act in the US on corruption, that you cannot have any subsidies involved in corruption, otherwise you get into real trouble. And they say to the State Department, we're going to sell Tenke-Fungurumet, and we're going to sell it for $3 billion to a Chinese mining company. And you see that guy in the film, John Peterfam, from the State Department, said, and it was under the Obama administration, said, please don't sell it. It's our last American asset in the Congo. For the rest, it will be the Swiss. So, who are not Swiss, they are coming from South Africa. It's going to be the Kazakh people based in Luxembourg, so only tax havens. And then, and they said, we cannot make business in the Congo without corruption. So we're just selling it. So that was something that was really striking. So the Chinese don't have that, obviously. And so they are like really dominating that. So you need to find a solution to that. And I don't know where the solution is when it comes to cobalt. Maybe in copper you can divest and that, but cobalt, we serve 70% of the reserve. Either you phase out cobalt, you invest in technology and so on. But still, like the biggest battery manufacturers remain China. It's CATL, 30% of all the batteries. And all the innovation is also in China, and less in Europe. On Northvolt, Northvolt is really into big trouble. So it's a company in Sweden. They've made big losses and so on, which means that all this ecosystem and all this investment from the European Union is not working well at the moment. And I guess because it's the price to produce batteries is quite high compared to China. That's all.
I'm going to get into trouble. So I think those last two questions, if you come and see Quentin, he's very kindly said he'll answer them. I'll get in trouble if you don't, because so many people behind the scenes have been working long, long days. Thank you so much to our panel. Thank you, Leah. Thank you, Richard. And an extra big thank you to the director of the film. And thank you all for coming.
Thank you for listening. You can subscribe to the LSE Events podcast on your favourite podcast app and help other listeners discover us by leaving a review. Visit lse.ac.uk/events to find out what's on next. We hope you join us at another LSE event soon.